The Guardian.
Hello, buongiorno, and welcome to Film Weekly's Venice Film Festival special. I'm Jason Solomons, coming to you from the Lido as the 68th Venice Film Festival enters its final stages. On this show, I've an overladen gondola of talent and conversation. Zan Brooks and I cast our eyes over the films vying for the Golden Lion, and we're also joined by Leslie Felperin, critic for the film business Bible Variety. We'll also hear from a wide range of stars and artists who dropped in on the festival, sprinkling their various forms of filmic fairy dust along the red carpet. We've got Italian icon Monica Bellucci, documentary maker Frederick Wiseman, screenwriter Abby Morgan, American director Todd Solondz, and Italian director Emanuele Crialesi, all sharing their Venetian experiences. Yes, it's the capolavoro of film podcasts, a masterpiece to you. It's Film Weekly from Venice. Much of the conversation over the Vino Rosso in the early part of the festival was taken with the opening shot of the movie Burning Summer. It's by French auteur Philippe Garrel and stars his son Louis Garrel alongside 30 seconds of Italian star Monica Bellucci absolutely naked. As if the muggy 95% humidity heat here wasn't enough, I went along to ask this screen siren how, at the age of 47, she was still finding the confidence to disrobe. I discovered more about the shoot and the shot than I'd even bargained for.
Frédéric, il me voit même plus. Ouais, il m'a mis, il me l'a montré. Et puis.
En amour, c'est chacun pour soi.
Et actually, I was intrigued by the story. And I'm saying in English because I think he's a unique author with his own person, and he really does what he wants to do. So he's a take it or leave it kind of guy, you know. And but that's why I think it's interesting. And also, I was touched by the interaction between Louis Garrel, the son, and Philippe, the father, because there is a lot of respect, admiration, and affection between them. So on set, there was really a great atmosphere because of that. And also, I was intrigued by the story. And the story is a confrontation between two couples. Louis and I play a couple where he's a famous painter and I'm an actress who is soon to be famous. And she can be described as an amoureuse, someone who needs to be the center of attention and forever adored, a bit like a child. So I'm not surprised that the character is an actress.
Are you une amoureuse?
Oui, une amoureuse, oui, mais not crazy like her, but une amoureuse, oui. J'adore être dans la passion. I love to be, you know, sometimes I'm a victim of passion, and I think this is so painful, and at the same time is the thing who makes you alive some way.
It's interesting to see you're working with a father and son, a family atmosphere on
and
set.
The grandfather too. In the end is the grandfather, yeah. But he died a few months ago.
And you often work with Vincent Cassel, your husband. You're used to working in a family situation. Is that, how does that work on a film set, working with someone that you know so well? Is it harder or easier?
It's easier, actually. And actually, we've done a few films together, Irreversible, Brotherhood of the Wolf, L'Appartement. In England, there was Flashback. No, it was...
You call it L'Appartement.
Well, L'Appartement.
Easy translation.
Yeah, L'Appartement. And but now we have a few projects together again. And so we are very happy to work together again. It's been a long time, actually. And for me, I like to have this possibility of beyond family and work. And actually, when I did the film with Garella, I just gave birth to my second child. And just 1 month before. So it was so funny because I was playing someone dangerously sexy, and at the same time I was breastfeeding each 2 hours, you know. So it was so funny.
Not many actresses would have done a nude scene when they're breastfeeding.
I know, but actually I think that's why it's beautiful, because it's anti-fashion, this nudity. You know, it's very round, and it's just something that... It's like if women are scared today of this kind of body, the biological beauty, the beauty of the youth is going to finish one day, and then another kind of beauty comes. I'm so happy that I'm going to another moment of my life where I don't have to deal anymore with the beauty, but I feel free. It's like I'm going to come out from the, from the mask.
Was there a sense that this opening of this film, the shot of you naked, was you saying, look, here I've been naked before, you've all seen me before, this is the new me, you can look at it if you want?
No, it's a moment of generosity, because you're not in perfect shape, but you give yourself to the film. But this is an actor attitude, no? You think about the film and about the character, not about you.
Well, I'm glad you say that. I don't think all actresses in this business do think that.
I think it's beautiful also because it's not perfect. And it's more human, it's more moving, this kind of nude, because it's not perfect. So, but actually, when I met Philippe, I was a bit surprised about this difference in age between husband and wife. And so I asked if there was a reason for that, and he answered no. Actually, I want you on my movie and Louis, but I don't care about the age. And I thought I'm lucky that I'm a European actor, because in America this would have been the subject of the movie.
Only slightly less glamorous than Monica Bellucci is Guardian critic Zan Brooks, who joins me as usual on The Lido. Welcome, Zan.
Thank you. I look like $100 here, don't I?
$100 Hong Kong dollars. And we're joined, as we often are in Venice, by a friend, Leslie Felperin from the Film Biz Bible Variety. Welcome again.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Now, going into Venice, it was a lot of, I think, pressure on the lineup to deliver, to be good, to kind of show that Venice was a necessary part of the world's festival circuit. You traipsed that more than most people I know, Leslie. So has Venice this year floated your boat?
I think eventually, yes, it has. I think things have kind of picked up. I thought the start was a little bit disappointing. I mean, some great names. On paper, it looked fantastic. You know, we got Roman Polanski and, you know, Steve McQueen and Thomas Alfredson, you know, big name stuff. And but it had some big boots to fill, because Cannes was very good this year, I think. And it was, you know, quite a satisfying festival. And Venice has always got to kind of punch its weight, because it's right before Toronto, which also, you know, sucks up a lot of the big world premieres. But I think it's been good. I mean, I wasn't crazy about some of the first few films. The Polanski, I thought, was disappointing. I don't really like Polanski anyway. Rapist. And there was the other one. There was
that alleged? Do we have to put an alleged in? I don't think so.
I think it's pretty much a matter of... I think he was practically... He was
statutory,
convicted.
Statutory,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, he was convicted. Well, it sounded like, you know...
Is what Whoopi Goldberg was calling the okay, kind of, or the less bad rape.
There's no such thing as less bad rape. Anyway.
I'd have to say his film, Carnage, had nothing to do with any of that.
No,
but
nothing.
We don't let it lie.
No, exactly. Well, except that it was a kind of tweaking of PC sensibilities.
Right.
And I thought there was a definitely sort of subtext there of kind of getting back at his critics and getting people who would insist that he should go spend time in jail. Anyway, but I thought, because the Madonna film, of course, which I understand discussed in great detail already, we don't need to rehash, which was a disaster. But then it picked up. I mean, the Steve McQueen film was fantastic. Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, brilliant piece of work. Even the surprise film, which I didn't see last night, but our good friend Wendy Ide from The Times and my colleague Justin Chang was telling me was excellent, which a Chinese film whose name escapes me at the moment.
People Mountain, People Sea.
It was supposed to be great, actually. So I think there's been, you know, a nice balance of surprises and big names. It's an old school festival which kind of gets the balance just right.
Let's start with the British presence, which going into it looked very strong. Last year, of course, Britain took all its prizes to all its film to Toronto. No films were here from Britain on the Lido. And this year, Marco Muller, the director, has managed to snaffle some big ones. Even people who've made the name at Cannes previously were here. I'm talking about Steve McQueen with his new film Shame. We're going to look also at Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And we're also going to look at Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights. But I think we'll start with Shame, Zan, because it seems to be the one that's maybe just nudging in front to win the Golden Lion on Saturday night.
Yeah, I'm always wary of doing the jingoistic tub-thumping for the Brits are coming, the Brits are coming. It sounds very sort of Daily Mail, doesn't it? And yet, it did seem to me that the festival really came to life and really found sort of fifth, sixth gear on Monday morning when Shame arrived. And Shame is a really sort of devastating kind of open wound of a film with fantastic performances from Michael Fassbender and Kerry Mulligan as this damaged brother-sister. He's a sex addict, she's this sort of self-abusing wannabe singer, and they're kind of locked together. And it's all set in a New York that is painted as this kind of sterile hell of bachelor pads and anonymous office blocks. And it's just one of those kind of agonising long dark nights of the soul of a film. And just perfectly done. I was not such a fan of Hunger, his previous film, as other people. But this is a properly sort of cinematic, muscular piece of work.
I think it's also a piece of work that comes from the art world as well. He obviously started as an installation artist, and that kind of chimes with the Biennale kind of sensibility. You know, Venice is an art project as much as it is a film kind of. I mean, it's part of the cinema. I've got some building going on here. They're constructing Venice as we speak. Brilliant.
Atmosphere. Yeah. It's nice. Yeah.
It's going to be easy to edit. But I do think that there's a sort of a nice synergy between that, because I think his work in Shame is particularly artistic. There are some sort of very almost showy shots, but there's a particular one about running through the streets of New York, which chimes with some of Steve McQueen's early installation work. And then there's a bit of story on there as well, and very actually affecting emotional character studies, particularly played well by Fassbender.
Yeah, I'm quite skeptical of work done by visual artists moving into film, and so quite often it's sort of as if they think they've just reinvented the wheel. Although there's been some good work. Gillian Waring's film Soft May, which had just opened in the UK, I thought was really good. I was like Zan, I was a little bit skeptical about Hunger. I thought it was a little bit chilly, a little bit too installation-like. What really knocked me out about Shane is that he's really kind of grasped narrative, and you know, it's really proper storytelling, albeit with a lot of kind of lacunae. You know, not exactly sure what's gone on between the brother and sister, what's in their past. But I thought it struck the balance just right. You know, I mean, it's a classic piece of art filmmaking, but just on every level, every technical craft is exquisitely done. Great performances. It was just an outstanding piece of work, and I think it's got a good chance of winning. I mean, I would think I'd be absolutely gobsmacked if it didn't come away with something, given who the jury is. We've got Todd Haynes on there, Darren Aronofsky, pretty smart guys, you know, and women. So I think it's likely to win something. It's a very formalist film, but a very beautifully done one.
Loved Michael Fassbender's shirts in this film. He looked great. I thought his belts, his shirts, his trousers, and then he takes them off as well, and I quite like what was underneath.
Yes, well, the foie is all we can say. He's not no reason not to feel confident being naked on screen, does he really? Yeah.
Well, Leslie, you mentioned that you enjoyed the narrative of Shame, and it was one reason that Steve McQueen hired a co-writer on this film as well, Abby Morgan, who's famous for her work, I suppose, on television with Sex Traffic and the recent BBC series The Hour. I went to track her down. This was her first Venice Film Festival, to find out more about how she worked with Steve McQueen.
It was a true collaboration in every sense, and it started with Steve and I meeting for a drink because, you know, various people had said, you know... American agent said, we shared an American agent, said you must get together, and we sat down for what was going to be an hour, both saying, we haven't got long, can't stay. And I think 3.5 hours later, we just went, yeah, well, I might work with you, what do you think? Yeah, I might work with you. Very playground, you know? And then we just, that's really how it started, and it was incredibly easy, you know?
So did he have an idea? Was that what he was meeting you for?
No, I think what was great was that it came out of, I think Steve wanted to write a love story with a kind of a gun and a kind of different kind of political film, and this is a film that I think is political in a very different way. It's sexually political, yeah. And about, you know, the politics and of those relationships. So I think that was very much the starting point for him, and I think we sort of riffed. It's the only way I can describe it, and I really feel like the film came out of that relationship. So it was a blank page, you know, absolutely a blank page, and it was just through us talking about. And I think, you know, I was very. We talked a lot about mortality and a lot about sort of desire and constant temptation, and particularly I think we were very obsessed with the notion of the internet and how available porn was, and that became a really kind of key inspirational point for us.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite the computers play a kind of main part. Yeah. You know, they're portals onto the world. Mm. There are lots of windows in your film, and one of them being a laptop that you open like a window.
Totally. Yeah, no, I think, in a way, you know, when we started working on this film together and we started writing it, we literally wrote it in the Standard Hotel. You know, it started with us.
Which we see at the end of the...
Yeah, and it's a very... You know, in a way, and you look out across the Hudson, and I think the landscape, the city became very another kind of important ingredient, and it was just the most, I mean, to be honest, it's been one of the most organic and true collaborations I've had. So, you know, it's very difficult to see the seams. It was just constantly building, and Steve's inspirational, you know, in terms of saying, you know, let's just walk. You know, and he walk, you know, New York is the city you walk in. Yeah. And I think he was very clear about the notion of, you know, a kind of a sexual sort of time bomb going on, but within the confines of a concrete, steel, glass city. And so,
let me say that this might please you, is that as I was watching it, apart from thinking, oh, look at all that sex, I was thinking, this is a really great New York movie.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for Steve, but I think we both bonded over our love of, you know, films, as you do, and we talked a lot about Scorsese, and you know, Steve's seen so many movies, and that was very exciting for me, and so, you know, I think it is a homage in a way to that kind of period of 70s filmmaking, but I think, you know, what Steve's bringing to it is something very fresh and very different and really turning it on its head.
Zan, not only was British cinema represented by Shane, but another different side of British cinema represented by Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, directed by a Swede, Thomas Alfredson. Have they let the right one in here?
They really have. Let the Right One In, as I'm sure you remember, was my film of the year about 2 years ago, and I thought that was great. Yeah. A Swedish vampire love story. And this, of course, on the face of it, is completely different, and yet it's also about characters who live in the shadows and are largely dependent on each other for survival. Mm. Except in this case, they're the spies at this vast MI5 bunker in London called the Circus, which is your classic unglamorous office again. Really, it's full of little grey men, kind of shuffling paper and smoking too much and peering into the shadows in search of a mole at the top of the circus. And it's also got a really terrific performance from Gary Oldman. And it's terrific because it's not the big bells and whistles showstormer of a tour de force. It's very down in the mix necessarily because Smiley is this diffident little man hiding in the dark corners. And he does it absolutely brilliantly. And then he's surrounded by this, you know, roll call of British greats, both young and old. You've got John Hurt as Control. You've also got Tom Hardy as the sort of film's rogue element, this Ricky Tarr character over in Istanbul. And Benedict Cumberbatch as this sort of closeted operative who's outwardly very groomed, but inwardly is sort of gradually coming apart at the seams. You can almost see him being unpicked as the film goes on. It's a terrific handling of the Le Carré labyrinthine novel and, you know, boils it down very well to just over 2 hours.
I love the production design and the kind of clothing, the costume. I thought it kind of got 70s London just right, but in the way that it was a kind of completely lost world, another planet, really. And I think that sort of thing will really appeal, certainly to British viewers and BAFTA juries and that sort of thing. I was amazed, really, by this kind of, by how he got that world right when considering, you know, Thomas Alfredson was from Sweden. And maybe Sweden probably looks like that still a bit now.
Cleaner, though, and more IKEA everywhere, I should imagine, actually. I mean, Alfredson's first film that I know of is a film called Four Shades of Brown, which is a fantastic three-hour comedy, very, very, very black.
All the shades of brown.
Yeah, and I think Four Shades could have been easily used as the title for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, even though it's got the same number of words. I think the production design is amazing on it. Just every frame has got great details in it, just the way, like, the documents in the archive are transported by dumbwaiter. You know, you expect to see sort of computer punch cards at any second. I mean, it was the kind of glaucous lighting that really did it for me. And it doesn't look anything like the original miniseries that we saw in the 70s, which everything looked like it was shot in the Athenaeum, you know, beautiful wood paneling and whatnot. Instead, it was this kind of grotty, fluorescent lit, you know, sort of functional space. And it reminded me of like where my father used to work in think tanks at the time, which was just sort of full of these kind of nerds, basically. You know, I think they say something in the production notes, you know, that there were like sort of two kind of people who went into serve their country, either the kind of the heroic soldier types who joined the army and the nerds who joined, you know, MI6. And that this is a film about the nerds, really, and the way they kind of end up kind of scratching each other's eyes out. And it's also, it's like the anti-Harry Potter movie as well. You know, it's like, you know, It's got that amazing roll call. In fact, there's even some overlaps, one or two. It would certainly get Gary Oldman. Yeah. It's so much so more so different and so, but just as classy.
Is it as if MI6 has been recruiting at Hogwarts rather than Oxford?
Yes, exactly.
I loved it too, and I think if it doesn't win here, I think it'll win at the BAFTAs and probably go on to the Oscars as well, because it's a, you know, it doesn't maybe take art form forward in any way. But I do you know what I loved about it? I loved its story. It's a film here. So often auteurs, I find kind of, you know, look at me, look at what I'm doing to the art form. But this one just kept, because it's a thriller, it kept going right to the very end. You had to keep watching. It kind of propelled itself forward, and I thought that was almost novel of it in a way.
No, I mean, it's an incredible piece of adaptation. I mean, it's a big book, and, you know, it made, you know, a 7-hour miniseries, you know, which actually, if you watch it back now, is a little bit kind of, you know, loose, and there's a lot of filler scenes and a lot more details and stuff like that. But I thought it was an incredible work of adaptation, and a very free adaptation. There's things that are added, and there's this fantastic scene where they're all having a Christmas party, and someone's dressed up as Lenin and leading them all in a, you know, a rousing rendition in perfect Russian of the Russian national anthem, the Soviet Union national anthem of the time. But I think it might not translate as well abroad. I think we really like it. We're Brits. We could follow the dialogue. We know the story well. I spoke to a couple of people from Russia and from France who are a little bit more lost and not quite as wowed over by it. So I'll be very interested to how this does box office-wise abroad.
Interestingly, you mentioned that. I spoke to some French critics who are absolutely in love with Andrea Arnold. Of course, Cannes was the place that she debuted Red Road, and it sort of discovered her, and Fish Tank as well. But she's in Venice here with her adaptation of Wuthering Heights. Now, there's a literary property that she has, for my money, exploded onto the screen and given a completely new take on it. Zan, were you blown and swept away by Wuthering Heights?
I feel that I was maybe in the end more shaken than stirred by it. I thought it was incredibly brave. I thought it was radical. It was a reinvention of what we see as the costume drama. Mm. It's basically a social realist bit of kind of harsh... It's basically a harsh bit of social realism sort of cast out onto the Yorkshire Moor and made to sort of wander amid the gorse, and there's lots of moths and beetles crawling around, and character, you know, the plot is peppered with profanities and has a animalistic al fresco sex scene that I don't remember from reading the book. Maybe it's in the first edition somewhere.
I think it's in the Cliff Richard version of Heathcliff.
Yeah, of course, we mustn't forget Cliff's rendition of Heathcliff, which bears no relation to the one we see here, where Heathcliff is actually black. There's an implication that he's a fugitive slave. And so that makes the film more about race than class, and that he's subjected to racial abuse. And that sort of form of oppression is shown to be what makes him so hardened and so angry and so sort of hell-bent on revenge. I think the key thing about Wuthering Heights, though, although there's a lot of kind of romantic, wafty, airy fairiness that's attached to it down the years, that it still is at the heart a love story between Heathcliff and Cathy, and you have to believe in those two characters, and I kind of didn't here. I felt that Arnold was wandering around too kind of fascinated with the form and too fascinated what she could do with it to concentrate on the two lead actors. You've got, you know, the kids are great.
Four lead actors, really.
Four lead actors, because it basically, you know, more than the first half is the kids, and they're good, and they grow up together in this sort of primitive Eden where they're neither quite, you know, siblings or lovers, but some sort of corruption of the two, some very innocent corruption of the two. Then you flash forward to them as, you know, young adults. And that's Kaya Scodelario, who is in Skins, and James Howson, who hasn't acted before. And both of them seemed a little self-conscious, a little ill at ease, and they didn't really kind of let me in. And you have to believe in that central duo for the film to work, and it didn't for me.
Mm. It was more, they were more subservient to the general aesthetic of wind and rain. There was a lot of rain in this film, I've got to tell you. They didn't make the Yorkshire tour. I know it's Screen Yorkshire kind of part funded it. It's not come to Yorkshire, really, sort of stuff. It's a prickly little kind of runaway hedgehog of a movie for me, this one. It kind of, you want to like it, but as soon as you kind of get near it, it kind of pugnaciously turns you away. There's a sense that, for me, that kind of the Chav aesthetic, that kind of prickly youth that she kind of chronicled well in Fish Tank and Red Road, is kind of here transposed to the costume drama.
Yeah, and I think it's a great idea to do it this way. I mean, it's Wuthering Heights has been adopted so many times before. We've seen versions by Rivette. We've seen, you know, Buñuel did a version set in Mexico. There's been Japanese versions. You know, there's been endless TV adaptations and, you know, big stars, little stars, nothing, you know, everything in between. And no one's ever tried to do it this way. And I think, you know, she's really brought her unique you know, tourist aesthetic to the movie and filtered it through and come up. It's unmistakably an Andrea Arnold film. I mean, it's in that very rigid Academy ratio. You know, considering a film about landscape is just extraordinary, the way it's, you know, feels very confined and stuff like that. But really, in the end, what's the point of Wuthering Heights without the love? You know, there's no sense of this in you know, intense passion. She's got the cruelty. I mean, it is a book very much about cruelty. And I think even the kind of, you know, what could be construed as stunt casting of casting a black, two black actors to play Heathcliff has some justification in the book. You keep mentioning how his black looks, his black hair, his black eyes. You know, it's taking it slightly literally in a way. Mm. I mean, initially I was talking to my husband on the phone this morning. He was saying that, you know, the papers are all over it. And, you know, oh my God, Wuthering Heights with a black guys, like, isn't that a shock? I mean, it almost sounds on the verge of racist to be so, you know, surprised by it. I think it's just an interesting, you know, choice, a little bit different. It's, you know, maybe sort of has tampers a little bit with the realism of the book of what, you know, you can believe that in the second half when he comes back super rich and having achieved great things in the world that would have been plausible. But it's not a film about plausibility. It's not a film about realism. It's a film about atmosphere and feeling and stuff like that. But it's that lack of feeling, I think, that really lets it down. I really wanted to love it. I wanted to be moved, and I just felt ultimately it was just a little bit too dry. And the acting is, she doesn't achieve the same things that she did with Fish Tank.
I don't think she wanted you to love it, though. Mm. I think she wants people to kind of go, oh, I'm going to go see Wuthering Heights because I love the book and I did it at O level at school and I love Kate Bush. Mm. But and all those people are going to go and they're going to get like two fingers stuck right up in front of their face. And I kind of like that about it.
What's the point of making a film if you don't love it? If you don't want people to love it? I mean, of course, challenge, of course, disturb, of course, shock, but you have to love it, otherwise what the hell is the point of doing it?
But I think that's my problem with the film. It's almost as if she's like, I'll fuck off the lot of you.
Yeah.
you and your film festivals.
It may remind me, I think it was not dissimilar in some ways to Bright Star, the film about Keats that Jane Campion did. You know, just I think it was the butterflies that set me off. You know, both films have lots of, you know, little shots of animals and stuff like that. And both are a kind of attempt to do something different with period. Mm. You know, there's a sense of the grottiness and stuff like that. Yes, there are beautiful, luscious costumes, but it's not the kind of really super polished kind of BBC adaptation quality that, you know, so but Bright Star had much more heart and much more feeling to it and more dialogue. I mean, she's it's a bold move, but I think it's slightly a perverse one to prune so much of the dialogue. And actually, what dialogue you have at one point Heathcliff saying fuck off you cunts, you know, which was I don't believe in the original Bronte.
That was lacking from the original Bronte. Andrea Arnold, Wuthering Heights. So a good year for British cinema, at least here in all its different forms, which is what I kind of like about it. American cinema was, of course, represented. Todd Haynes was here. Of course, he's on the jury and his Mildred Pierce was playing. But Todd Solondz, who's often here in Venice, he was here with Dark Horse, the story of a fat, unlovely 30-year-old who still lives with his mum and dad. Zad, are you a Todd Solondz fan?
I am, yeah. Real change of departure for Todd Solondz, isn't it? a tale of fat losers in suburbia. You know, he's really pushing the envelope here. And if I had a problem with the film, it's just that he lays on a great bad party and invites you in, and it's all so agonising and you know, butter-clenchingly embarrassing. And that's fun. But he's done it better than he has here. He's done it better in, you know, Welcome to the Doll's House or Happiness or even Life During Wartime, which was his sort of semi-sequel to Happiness a couple of years ago that was here in Venice. This felt like he was just covering old ground. I quite like the first half. I thought the first half was great, where you have the schlub loser who's living at home with his parents and his dad employs him. The parents were played by Christopher Walken and Mia Farrow, both utterly unrecognisable with sort of bad hair and slouched postures, pottering around the living room.
Seinfeld, I noticed.
They do watch Seinfeld, yeah. I'm sure Solondz is a fan of that. Then he meets Selma Blair, who initially is kind of way out of his league, but it turns out is just as sort of damaged and broken and miserable as he is. Up to that point, I was really going with it, and then I think it does lose its way and it casts around in search of an exit, and the sort of a lot of the heat kind of goes out of it.
Todd Solondz, I think, can be a remarkable filmmaker, but he seems to have sort of hit stride at the moment, and people want him to kind of do something else. I thought this one if you've never seen a Todd Solondz movie, this would probably be your perfect entry level Todd Solondz.
It would be great if he did Middlemarch, like Andrea Arnold or something like that. It really is a surprising departure from his milieu. Yeah.
There weren't enough Jews in Middlemarch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm afraid I didn't see this one, but I didn't hear great things about it. So, but I can't really comment. I mean, I did like his earlier films very much. I particularly like Happiness, which is one of those films like reading about the Gulag that just cheers me up because, you know, but therefore the grace of God go I kind of feeling. But I can't really comment. I didn't see it.
One of the most striking things about it is early on there's a sort of shot of a shopping mall in America, and one of the great American company signs is blurred out, and I thought, well, maybe he's given us an unfinished print here. So I went to find Todd Solondz and find out what on earth was going on with his blurring of the logo of Toys R Us.
Yeah, well, they didn't give us permission, so we can't expose their logo. I prefer that to creating a fake logo or fake name. It would jump out, I think, as being very fake, in the way that phone numbers in movies that begin 555 always pull you out of the experience because you know how fake it is. So since I think audiences today are very familiar with the blurring effects from reality programming, it actually brings more authenticity to the location.
Mm, okay. And did they tell you why they didn't want to be associated? I mean, I can understand, but I don't know. Maybe this film doesn't. I wouldn't seem there would be no toys harmed in the making of this movie.
Well, I was told that it's because I was directing it that anything associated with me they didn't want to be associated with.
Well, Todd, that makes me sad. What does your mother think of that?
Well, they're not the only company that doesn't want to be associated with me. I'm blacklisted from so many, so it's something that we were prepared for, and it worked out in the end, nevertheless.
I assume this is nothing to do with palindromes. This is nothing to do with life during wartime. Probably, it all goes back to Happiness, I think, presumably, that you're blacklisting.
Oh, the blacklisting. Yeah, I guess that's probably where it started. Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, especially the toys thing. I can see that. But is this a kind of backhanded Oscar? In fact, that you're blacklisted from corporate America?
I don't see it as I don't see any advantages to it. It sometimes when you're not given permission, it can make you, force you really to be more resourceful.
So we seem to have dealt with some of the main films in competition vying for the Golden Lion, but part of the joy of a film festival is seeking out other stuff. Now, Leslie, I mean, presumably because you're Variety film critic, and Variety is nothing if not the spice of movie life. Have you been sort of hunting around in sidebars?
Yeah, it's been great, actually. And one of the things I like about my job in writing for Variety is because we do such a wide breadth of films, and we do a little bit more than competition, a little plug for our company there. But I get assigned to do things that, you know, there are not just the competition, so some of my favorite films have been things I just, you know, kind of hadn't high hopes of, but turned out to be terrific. I did have high hopes of Vivan Las Antípodas. I apologize to any Spanish speakers for mangling the title there.
So it's Long Live the Antipodes.
Long Live the Antipodes, basically, by a Russian filmmaker who I've been tracking for a while called Viktor Kosakovsky. And it's just great. It's this wonderful idea where, you know, there's only very few places in the world that fit these criteria, but it's you know, finding places that are exactly opposite each other on the globe. So, you know, one is in Argentina at this like tiny little pontoon bridge where these two kind of, you know, guys, you know, run, you know, the ferry across the river, which is paired, you know, it's directly opposite if you tunneled through the globe with Shanghai. So he sort of, you know, shows footage in both places, and they kind of speak to each other and chime with each other, and there's a sort of, you know, rhyme and compare and contrast quality about it. And then another pair is Chile and Siberia, and then Honolulu and, not Honolulu, a volcano in Hawaii, and an African country where this woman is sort of playing, you know, they've got all these elephants kind of wandering around, and she's complaining because they leave poo all over the compound where they live and stuff like that. And it's got great little ideas, beautiful little visual metaphors, like, you know, the waves of the volcano lava, which is sort of black and with red sort of peeping through underneath in the fiery parts, you know, it's chimed with, you know, and echoed in the texture of the elephant's hide. Mm. And it's just, it was beautifully done. It was kind of experimental filmmaking on a great order. And then I also loved a great British film called Shockhead Soul by Simon Panwell, which is, you know, a very long project. He's an art project he's been doing, which was really kind of wonderfully sui generis. You know, there are elements of documentary in it and fiction. And it just, Cronenberg. It's on a very similar subject to A Dangerous Method, the Cronenberg film that was here. Because it's about a guy named Daniel Schreiber who wrote a kind of insider's, you know, account of what it's like to have schizophrenia in the early years of the 20th century, and Freud was terribly impressed by it, and Jung both wrote about it. So it was a beautiful film with just very surreal and strange imagery, use of kind of animation and documentary, and
it's called Shockhead Soul.
Shockhead Soul, and that was great, and I hope it comes out in the UK. It was a really terrific movie, and one of my other favorite, just to slip in really quickly, it was a great film called The Arrival of Wang, a Italian film in which an alien from outer space shows up, and this girl has to go and translate it. And the reason he speaks Chinese, because they've been studying our planet and they worked out that Mandarin was the most widely spoken language on the planet. So he only speaks Chinese. And it was like an episode of The Twilight Zone, and it was really kind of shonky and silly and funny, but it was great, actually. I really enjoyed that, too. So it's good. You know, that's the great thing about film festivals, is you can go and find, you know, truffle out these little kind of gems.
One of the things that I was really looking forward to, it's not such a truffling, but it's always good to kind of catch up with Frederick Wiseman, a documentary maker who I've long, long admired. And God bless him, after years spent chronicling abattoirs and educational institutions and government buildings, he finally got to enjoy himself at 81 years old. He went into The Crazy Horse, a night spot of nude cheek in Paris, and spent 11 weeks. Here's him telling me about his experiences on Crazy Horse.
Merci beaucoup, les filles.
The only other time I'd been at the Crazy Horse was in 1957 when I went with my father-in-law because he wanted to see some pretty girls dancing, so to speak. But I hadn't been back. The only other first time I was back after that was in the spring of 2009, which is a gap, if my math is right, of about 52 years. Which is not a comment on the Crazy Horse. It's just that I wasn't there. And I went back because a friend of mine had told me that Découflé was putting on a new show, and so I thought that might make an interesting movie. And as a matter of fact, the shooting started maybe a week or two after I went back, because he was just starting the rehearsals.
How did you, to maintain the stillness of camera and decide the shots that you're going to go for when you're shooting the rehearsals? Because you had to say, when you did the ballet, you were in the wings and you could have a kind of whole pan. Here you're really quite tight on some of your of your shots.
Well, there were some differences. The Crazy Horse theater is very small. The Paris Opera Ballet, there's something like, 2,200 seats. The Crazy Horse are 225, I think, or 240, I don't remember. At the ballet, except for the dress rehearsals, I could never shoot from the front of the theater, which turned out to be a great advantage because the position on the stage was much better and much more unusual in the front of the theater. But at the Crazy Horse, the Crazy Horse management let me shoot from the side, from the back, from the middle of the audience, as long as I didn't disturb the audience. And that was fine.
Would you be with what camera were you using? Because, I mean, it's a small space. So
what's a Sony 900? This is the first film that was shot digitally. All the others were shot on film. But because of money issues, it's possible to get the money. Shooting on HD is so much cheaper.
And was it handheld, or you used tripods?
A combination. The performances were almost always tripod. The rest was principally handheld.
Because shooting in a nightclub, you have all sorts of lighting issues. You know, it's dark.
There are technical issues in order to. You have to take advantage of their lighting. Their lighting was terrific, and we were able to take advantage of it.
No, it doesn't even look spectacular.
It wasn't lighting that was added for the film, but it's lighting that looks terrific on film.
Is And you saw Crazy Horse too. We were like little old men shuffling around in our raincoats in there. It was a strange, fabulously unerotic experience, though.
Oh, it's art, though, isn't it, Jason? Yeah. And you've got the choreographer, Philippe, who's your classic tortured artist, who's saying he's got to put on a show called Evolution very, very quickly. And he's saying, you know, you can't give me 2 weeks to do Evolution. I need more time. And then you actually see quite in great detail and for long periods the actual show itself. And it all just seems to be, you know, girls writhing around and undulating with, you know, leopard skin prints across their bum and things like this. And you think, you know, how's that evolution? But there you go. And of course, we see the rehearsal where whatever erotic promise these images have is comprehensively doused by the sound of Philippe saying, buttocks, buttocks, kiss. But, you know,
And the feel of it, like an 81-year-old bloke kind of walking around with his camera as well. Don't mind me.
Well, he's still got it, hasn't he? You know, and I guess being 81, you get the unfettered access to everywhere. They probably think he's no threat anymore.
Exactly. That's how Bertolucci still makes movies, I think, as well. Did you have any other little gems? What's, I suppose, your most memorable shot or scene, if not movie?
In terms of movies, I really liked Alps by Yorgos Lanthimos, Greek director who did Dogtooth. This is it's got a fantastic idea. I mean, I admit that for the first half of it, I was comprehensively lost in the Alps because he's withholding information. But basically, Alps refers to a company that stands in for the recently deceased. So the bereaved relatives can call Alps and they will come and play your daughter who's just been killed in a car crash or your late husband, and they will reenact precious moments from your life and they will read the lines like really bad actors, and it is just a sort of the debasement of memory, I guess it's about, and maybe the suggestion that we're all bad actors sort of trying to play a role and trying to kind of fit in. I thought that was a fantastic, cold but brilliantly managed film.
I have to say that was, if there's one film, I thought this was a great festival, most things were quite good. I hated Alps. I'm stony faced over Alps.
Why did you hate it? You thought it was just too nasty?
Yeah, it was nasty, cold, and left me no. I found it very difficult to get in there and what he was trying to say and what he was trying to do. And I'm not sure if he was trying to say anything, but I mean, listening to you, yes, he was trying to say all of that. You know, sometimes I just don't like, you know, there's some people you think, well, they might be clever. I just don't like them. I don't like him.
I think that's fair enough, but I do think that there was a real intelligence and a sort of biting insight. Yeah. Behind this film,
I don't want to have dinner with him. You had dinner with him.
I had an interview with him, and if anything, I did like the film a little less afterwards. Yeah. But you know, that's the tyranny of the interview.
We had him on the show last year, and I'm not having him on again. He was perfectly polite. I just don't like him.
You know, I think that he is just a groomed, successful young director. He's not really giving anything away, and that's probably as much my fault as his that I didn't get him to kind of open up. But he's as chill and closed as his films are, I think. Mm.
And any scenes that stick in the mind?
Do you know, when you ask that, the one that leaps to mind is an early the classic early shot of Kate Winslet blowing chunks across the coffee table in Carnage, which just had the audience kind of, you know, on their feet pretty much. You know, and then interestingly, there's always these weird echoes in festivals that you see things kind of repeated. And so a couple of days later, during Contagion, the Steven Soderbergh film, we had Gwyneth Paltrow try the same thing, and yet could only kind of, you know, muster up a thin white froth, whereas Kate Winslet, you know, turned it up to 11.
Didn't she? Is that one of the best on-screen baths? Because there's The Exorcist.
I think Mr. Creosote in Meaning of Life is probably still the standard.
Witches of Eastwick has a good bath in that. All that cherries coming out of him.
I'll take your word for it.
It's a strange 10 best.
I try to block these things out, you know. Exactly. Just like watching people. Yeah, well,
but yeah, seeing Kate Winslet do it really is, you're quite one in the eye, I think. I loved a Chinese movie, a Hong Kong movie, in fact, called A Simple Life by An Hui, which had Andy Lau, who we normally see as an action hero as a policeman, in this kind of really kind of schlubby role, as he was like a film production accountant looking after his maid who'd gone into a nursing home. It was just really tender and sort of, well, as the title says, A Simple Life. It was unfettered and rather beautiful. And I also rather fell in love with an Italian movie called Terra Firma, which was by Emanuele Crialesi, who did Respiro a few years ago. And he takes you to these holiday islands, basically, and kind of shows what lies beneath. And of course, Italy at the moment, these islands are having a lot of problems with African immigrants who are escaping Libya and Algeria and arriving on their shores, washing up. Now, these ancient fishing communities are now sort of being disbanded and getting decommissioned by the central government in Brussels. So you get 100 grand to demolish your boat, so it's worth much more demolished than it is afloat, because the fishing has been replaced by fishing out dead bodies from the sea around these islands. So I thought that was a really, really beautiful, simple Italian film in the sentimental mould. It is coming to the London Film Festival, which I guess is one of the next festivals on our stop. So I went to meet Emanuele Criolesi to find out where on earth he shot this film. Emanuele Criolesi, you're drinking Prosecco. Complimenti. Congratulations on your film.
Grazie.
Yeah, a little Prosecco in the afternoon. I think I'm going to get one too. So if they stop our interview for Prosecco, it's allowed. It's Venice. You know. For an Italian filmmaker like you to have your film in competition at Venice, is it more pressure or not? Because it's your home crowd. How do they respond to your film? Is maybe slightly more pressure for an Italian, I think.
Well, yes. I know Venice very well because I've been here before. And
I got my Prosecco, grazie.
Prego, cheers. Allora, cheers.
Cheers.
It's my home. It's a port. There is the sea. It's a metaphysical place. Everything looks fake, but it's real. So it's exactly the place you wanted to be.
And I mean, and your film also, all your films sort of take me, not on holiday, but they take me away. You know, Respiro took me to Lampedusa. Golden Door took me away from here, but to another place. And you've done it again here in your new film, it seems to me. You seem to specialise in that kind of genre of cinema. Terra Firma is anything but Terra Firma. It's a murky sea.
Yeah, no, I like journey. I like movements. I like exploration. The narrative I was reading is my best narrative is L'Odissea di Omero. And then I read also Salgari, all the adventurous book, the book that talks about movements, traveling, adventure, also intimate adventure, because with a trip, traveling is also a way to know ourselves, the way we cope with new things. So for me, movements is knowledge and evolution.
Where are you from, Emanuele?
I'm born in Rome, but I have origin from the south, Sicilian and Calabria.
So again, immigration and the tough life of those islands. I went to my honeymoon. I went to the Aeolian Islands, which are beautiful for me for my honeymoon. But Stromboli, Alicudi, these are tough places to live.
Yeah, tough place to live, but also magnificent place to live, in my opinion, for a certain time of your life, especially if you write and if you want to clear your mind and if you want to think about what is important to do and what is not important to do. I feel that if I live in the city, I forget what is really important. I get caught by thousands of things and mundane meeting that I forget myself. Then I need the island. I need the island also as an isolating dimension, just to see what I do next.
So what was this beautiful island that you shot Terra Firma on?
Linosa.
Where is that, and what was it like to work there, and the people, what are they like there?
It was fantastic because there are 250 people. We know newsstands, so they don't get information from the news. They have bad connection in television. They have the boat that sometimes don't even approach the island because the sea is too rough. So I found my paradise island where people are mostly uncontaminated. And I love people working, simply working, loving their island. And the welcome we got, I brought a group of 90 people for 4 months. The welcome we got in that island was amazing.
You increased the population of the island by like 35%, 40%.
Yes, absolutely. And now there are more because some babies are born after our arrival in the island. So
like an army.
No, so it was really, they were really, really helping the process of the film and participating. And I felt like in a big family, a large family. They were very scared about the political team. But then the moment, you know, the islanders always want to go. Because, you know, they always cry that there's nothing to do here. Lucky you that comes from the city. We want to. They're always crying about their isolation. But then they don't take the boat. But then I asked them, what if one day the boat will not be there anymore? And what if somebody will tell you, you cannot escape your island? What would you do? How would you feel? And then something triggered, and they let me before they were against it, because we don't want to black people here, because it's all about us. But then little by little, they change, they open, and they decide to welcome us there.
Well, I think the result is some wonderful pieces of cinema, some scenes, unforgettable scenes from the Venice Film Festival, really beautiful films. I always remember your scene from Respiro in the swimming pool, the empty swimming pool, children in there. This has the same coup de cinema, they say in France.
Si, in Italian.
And this is full of it, so delighted to meet you. Just wanted to talk to you and congratulate you. Complimenti.
Thank you very much. I loved
Terra Firma. It's a very Italian film, but I loved it.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. You were right on The Observer. Si, and when?
Questa domenica.
So next week I can read your review.
Yes.
Fantastico.
Well, as Emmanuel Crealesi said, you can hear this on Thursday and read me on Sunday in The Observer. For more of Zan, go to guardian.co.uk/film, where his videos, his real reviews and his writings are. You've been very busy, Zan. Well done.
Thank you very much, Jason. It's nice to hear, and it's nice to sit down and talk things over.
Yeah. Well, always nice to see you. We'll see you next week back in Blighty. Leslie, are you off with Variety, taking you off to another festival before London?
There's a chance I might go to Oldenburg, which I'm told is like the Sundance of the North, which I think now that Edinburgh's not quite the Sundance of the North, I guess the title's up for grabs. I'm a little skeptical. I mean, I'm perhaps the Sundance of North Germany, but... I don't know if I'll go because it's very, very close to it, but I might go and take my son who loves trains so we can go to Wuppertal.
Where Pina Bausch plays.
Pina Bausch's company, yes, exactly. I was inspired. He'll love to go on the underrails, so I might, for the first time, take my kid to a film festival, which is, I'm sure, a rod from my own back.
Yeah, make him watch Greek films by Yorgos Lanthimos. He'll love them.
That's what our house is like, you know.
Leslie Felper and Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. This has been the Film Weekly Venice Film Podcast Special. The music we've been using on the show this week is the beautiful Bach that peppers Steve McQueen's film Shame, as played by Glenn Gould. From me, Jason Solomons, on the Lido, and from my producer, Jason Phipps, back in London, it's Arrivederci, and we'll see you soon.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.